if you make a choice to build new fossil fuel infrastructure today, if you make a choice to do something that locks in an energy system that absolutely has to be wound down, what you are doing is you are taking years away from future generations and giving them to yourself.
Climate change is the challenge of this generation, but figuring out how we can help solve this problem, how we can make changes in our lives and in our homes, can seem mystifying, out of reach. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Today, we get into the details. How do you and I and our neighbors and friends change everything? How do we decarbonize our lives in service of turning climate change around? According to today's guest, Dr. Brett Favaro, one inroad is to electrify everything. This is a great conversation. We talk about technology, individual and collective responsibility, and what it's like to be a parent at this critical point in history. This is really one of those conversations that can leave us feeling more optimistic and more empowered, if you'll forgive the pun, to contribute to solving the problem of our lives. Let's dig in. Today, I am glad to be joined by a friend and colleague, Dr. Brett Favaro. Brett is author of The Carbon Code, How You Can Become a Climate Change Hero, and is also a passionate advocate for decarbonization in all aspects of our society. Brett, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Brett, lots of people start conversations about climate change by talking about the stakes, the urgency, the impending doom. But for this episode, I want to flip that. I want to start by talking about solutions that we're excited about. You spend a lot of time thinking about how to make changes in your own life and in society to address climate change in the time that we have. What most excites you right now?
So I'm going to say an answer that's probably going to start a lot of fights, but my answer is electrification. So electrification means essentially switching technologies out that currently use fossil fuels for energy and replacing them with things that use electricity for energy. So as a specific example, instead of burning natural gas to heat your home, you use a heat pump, which just moves the heat from outside into your home, and you use electricity to do it. And I'll tell you why. So the reason why I'm answering with technology, this is going to be like nails on a chalkboard to a lot of people, because a lot of people will say, well, no, technology doesn't matter. What matters is politics, it's justice, it's political power, it's all these other things. I don't disagree with any of that. But the reason why I answer with this technology is because if you don't have a physical way to achieve decarbonization, in other words, basically getting fossil fuels out of our energy system, if that was physically impossible to do without dramatically lowering quality of life, we would have a much harder time ahead of us. There would probably be no hope. But that's just not the case. The thing that electrification is showing us is that the future that does not use fossil fuels as our main energy system is a better future technologically than one that does. Whether you're talking about cars that use electricity instead of gas, these are just better cars. Anyone that's driven an EV will never go back. It's very, very rare that people will go back to gas after that. If you're talking about bicycling, right? Having an e-bike to get yourself around, this is an incredible technology that people are actually getting out of their cars to use if it can be safe. Heating your home with the heat pump, now you get air conditioning and heat instead of just heat. So any one of these technologies that we're talking about, once it is electrified, this is just better. And so this provides a very optimistic way forward that just wouldn't exist. We would have to be only talking about doing less, but now we're talking about doing differently. And that's a much different conversation with people that are on the fence about climate action.
So let me ask you briefly then, so we are all on the same page about the full scope of this opportunity. Why do some people contest what you're saying right now?
Because technology itself does not lead to progress. So there's a version of this. Let me give an example. So carbon capture and storage. So this is something where, you know, if I run a coal plant, I can do some stuff and capture some of the emissions from it and lock it underground, or, you know, the same is true of oil. And this is a technology that you know, some are excited about. There's a project in Iceland where you're literally sucking CO2 out of the air. You're sucking the harmful thing out of the air and locking it away. This technology primarily serves to give a rhetorical reason to not get off oil. That's how a lot of proponents use it, is they say, hey, we don't need to stop using fossil fuels because we can just suck up the CO2 later and clean up the mess after the fact. And the problem is this technology, it exists, but it does not exist at a scale that's meaningful. And for it to exist at that scale that's meaningful, we would have to see orders of magnitude decreases in cost. And we would have to see the effectiveness go way up. It's not impossible that that'll happen. But in the interim, the very existence of that technology, I would argue, is almost making it harder to argue to get off oil and gas, because it's always provided, if you look at the models, there's always this pathway where, you know, we don't do anything about oil for a while. We just sort of suck it all up after. And so an opponent of what I just said would say, well, I'm the same thing. So the existence of heat pumps means that people just won't conserve as much. What I would argue is there's a fundamental difference, that the existence of the technology doesn't imply it's necessarily going to be used or it's necessarily going to be equitable. But if the technology did not exist in the first place, if there was no hope for that, then we would have to approach decarbonization very differently.
Right. But this technology does exist. And I'm a big fan of solutions that we have right now. So, you know, this makes me think back to when I was first reading your book, The Carbon Code. And I remember having conversations with you about some aspects of that book, which, well, often in my work, I often tend to focus on some of the structural and societal aspects of problems. And there's a lot in your book about the things that individuals have, the options that people have right in front of them. The Carbon Code came out a few years ago now, and a lot of things have changed, right, in the world of electrification and fossil fuels and climate action. So, you know, I'm wondering, if you were going to write the Carbon Code 2.0, are there things you would change? What would you change first?
Yeah, the important thing to remember is I wrote that book in 2015 and 2016. Okay, so Barack Obama was still the United States president at that point. This was a very, very different world. And since that book came out, the conversation around this question of can individuals even affect climate change, or is this all a big policy thing, has gotten way more sophisticated than when I wrote the book. And I think what I've come to understand is that, well, first of all, I have some blind spots. And there's some stuff in that book, particularly when I start talking about the different solutions. There's a line in there that, you know, recently we had this heat dome in BC that killed hundreds of people. And I had a line in the Carbon Code about air conditioning, about how, you know, for most people, it's a luxury. It's not a necessity. And I talk about how adopting, if billions of people were to get air conditioning, it would add to the climate problem. And what I missed by writing that is how that can be weaponized, right? For poor people that live in homes that are not adequately ventilated, it is not a luxury. It is a death sentence to not have the ability to cool your home. And that's only going to become a bigger problem as the world gets hotter. So we have to be really careful not to do these. And this is what happens with climate change, because climate change affects everything, is that it's tempting to talk about everything. And I probably, if I was doing it again, would not try to talk about everything. I would try to talk about the underlying logic that we should be using when we're trying to approach these questions, because you run the risk of talking about things you don't really know what you're talking about. And I think that's one where, you know, I had an oversight there, and, you know, I do apologize if anyone's listening to this, if that did cause harm. So what would I change is I wouldn't make sweeping statements like that. I don't think it's wrong to approach it from an individual perspective, in the sense that you can be a leader. I mean, there's lots of social science about this, about the impacts that, like, if you are somebody that has a bit of money, right, and you have the financial ability to be able to pursue these things, you are absolutely obligated to do so, right? Because you can be a leader, you can, by being the first one to do it, it's always going to be more expensive. And then you can sort of pave the way for your neighbors to do it as well. So you do that thing and then you talk about it and you try and make it go viral. I think that stuff still holds. It's not true that we're totally powerless about this. But I guess, you know, not trying to write a book where you have to talk about everything is something I would probably advise people if they're starting a project like that today.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I mean, it's commonplace to see people talking about solutions to climate change as if there are these heroic silver bullet solutions that will work for everyone all at once. But these can obscure or erase so much possibility for local solutions, regional solutions that work for particular people in a particular place.
Yeah, there's commonalities. I mean, not using fossil fuel for energy is the commonality. Getting distracted about whether we should have air conditioning or not. I mean, there's sort of some assumptions there. If everyone's using air conditioning and it's all powered by coal and we're using refrigerants that have high global warming potential, yeah, then that might not be good overall if everybody does that. That said, none of those are necessary. There's heat pumps now that use CO2-based refrigerants, right? They're more expensive, but they exist. You can have renewable energy. Like, none of these things are set in stone. There is a way to do this that doesn't cause climate catastrophe. And so, you know, if you just have sort of as your touchstone, justice, electrification, renewable energy for everything, if those are your basics, then you craft your specific solutions based on the context and you don't do these big sweeping things, because what you do in place A may look very different than what you do in place B.
Brett, I find myself trying really hard to put all of my energy into the positive things. And I know you share this philosophy with me. Don't engage in Twitter fights, you know, put energy into solutions. But there's a broader question here I want to ask you about, which is that try as we might, there's this baseline amount of energy that all of us working on climate change are putting into debating with one another. You know, maybe we're pushing more or less in the same direction, but I feel like we're still awfully divided over solutions. There's this baseline level of conflict and contestation that I do not think is helping the cause. What do you make of this?
I think everybody's scared. Because everybody that understands what's happening understands that there's an outcome here. There's a version of this where what we're about to experience is almost indescribably bad, right? That is still on the table. The thing with climate, if there's one thing I wish people could sort of walk away from is remembering that on Twitter and Facebook, binary thinking is the way to go, right? And that's sort of rewarded through the incentives that social media provides for you. As a result, you get a lot of whataboutism. So if I ever dare to say anything positive about electric vehicles, there'll be 50 people responding after being like, you know, EVs are bad, right? Here's all the things about EVs that are bad. Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. They're also essential. This is also an essential technology. It also is an enabling technology that if these get better, the batteries get cheaper, and then electrification can happen over here in a way that's really important. The concept of whataboutism, when you say something and that's, well, what about this? What about that? Really ties us in knots in the climate space.
What's the alternative?
A great thing that everyone should do is go online. Everyone in Canada should go onto the Pembina Institute website. They have this energy policy simulator, and it allows you to model, you know, what if the government did this policy? What if the government did that policy? What would happen to Canada's national emissions? And what you'll find is you can click any one of those, and almost none of them make a difference. The curve moves the teeniest little amount, even something huge, like everybody's now driving EVs. It moves, you know, a little tiny bit. If you click all of them, then we get to a good future. And that's what people need to take away from that, is that we have to do 50,000 things to create this future. All of those things will be better for us by the time, you know, it'll just create a better world. It's not just about fighting climate change, but we have to do all those things. And that's really frustrating, because we want to have one thing. I mean, take COVID as an example. Well, if you get your vaccine, this is all going to go away. Well, first of all, that's wrong. The vaccine was really important. It's probably the most important thing, but it has not ended COVID. And it probably never would have ended COVID, given the nature of that virus. You have to have non-pharmaceutical interventions. The same is true of climate. That in some ways should be very freeing to people, because if you are an expert in sustainable agriculture, right, you can do so much in that space. You don't have to worry yourself. Other people will be advocating for EVs. Other people will be advocating for carbon pricing. You know, there's all these policy areas where there is a person who is a super expert in that. We need to be able to make space to elevate those people that are working on those while we work on our own thing and sort of mutually support each other. And so I think, you know, being able to have people work as a team and not have to funnel everything into a couple big climate voices that do all, you know, that know all things about everything, right? Being able to allow lots of people to pursue lots of different things, I think is really important.
That's helpful. And you know, in that answer, you both made me more stressed out and then also helped me be less stressed out. I think, you know, specifically when you said there's not just one or two things we need to do, there's 50,000. I mean, I know that in an academic sense, but then I thought, oh my God, we need to do 50,000 things and we have 8 years, right?
Yeah, but you don't. We collectively do.
Exactly. And I think your comments are really helpful. And maybe this is an answer to my next question, because I'm also seeing this urgency to do something, this urgency to solve climate change, be weaponized by particular groups that have particular vested interests in particular versions of the future. The we don't have time to solve justice issues, we just have to do what we can do now camp. I don't know exactly what to do about that, and I don't know if you know what to do about that.
Well, I think of people roughly as being in three camps here, okay? And this is a drastic oversimplification, so I apologize to any social scientists listening to this. But bin number one, you've got people, you know, like you and I, people that are already activated, right? People that are, you know, super passionate about this, that are looking for levers to pull and will pull them when they're available. They do it in different ways. Some people will throw themselves in front of traffic. Some people will, you know, try and become an environment minister somewhere and everything in between. Like these are the people that are doing what they can. They may not agree with each other about how to do it, but they're activated. Bin number two are people that are also activated, but in completely the opposite direction. These are your anti-conservationists, right? Some of them are very slick. Certain oil executives, for example, that use their tremendous influence and intellect to stop climate action, to make the world a worse place. Some of them are more crude, people that would roll coal, for example, that have decided to make it their personal identity to drive a giant truck that they, you know, deliberately make pollute more because it's their identity. This camp exists, as uncomfortable as that is, and we will have an adversarial relationship with them. And our options are to make the camp smaller through persuasion. Perhaps we can convince, probably not the oil executives, but the coal rollers to, you know, to do a different way of life. But if that is what they're choosing to do, that is an adversary of climate action. So we can make that pool smaller, or we can disempower them politically by mobilizing, by organizing, by controlling the levers of power ourselves so that they, you know, aren't able to do what they're doing that would destroy the climate. But the third bin is the exciting one. This is the bin of people in the middle. And I think this is the biggest bin. These are the people that are sort of vaguely aware that climate change is a thing. They might've heard it on the news. They've noticed that people didn't used to die from heat in their city and now they're dying. And that's kind of weird. Like it's this sort of, they're aware it's there, but they either aren't activated. They don't know what to do about it. Maybe they recycle. They think they're already doing something about it. This is the bin that I think can be tipped into action in either direction. And I think there's some sophisticated messaging out there trying to tip them into the bad camp.
Okay, give me an example.
I'll just tell a really brief story. So I was out at an event the other day and the natural gas company had a tent, right? They were doing outreach. And ostensibly it was environmental outreach. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go up and talk to them. And so they did this little quiz game and they said, okay, here's the quiz. If you get it right, I'll give you a prize. And it's, what was one thing you can do to reduce your carbon footprint in your home? And I said, well, that's easy. Get rid of natural gas, install a heat pump. So it turned out that was the wrong answer. The right answer was to take a shower that's only 5 minutes in length, to restrict your showers to 5 minutes in length. And I said to them, okay, hold it a second. You know, think about this messaging here. You're taking an intimate activity from a person, right? They're showering. You're telling them how to shower. You're telling them how long to shower. You're getting right into this like very private part of someone's life. And you're telling them the thing that will help the climate is for you to do less of that thing. This is a message that either deliberately or out of ignorance will tip people into being an opponent of climate action. I mean, come on, that's a ridiculous thing to say to people. First of all, it's ineffective. Second of all, it just keeps you on natural gas, which we have to get off of, right? I can't think of a message that would be more likely to flip people that don't really know much about this into the wrong direction. So this is an example of the type of messaging that we have to remember people are bombarded with.
I can't believe we're still hearing things like this. I mean, you know, and I know this, but many of the listeners may not know, Brett, that this has been a tactic of the fossil fuel industry since the turn of the 21st century, at least, shifting the blame for climate change onto consumers. Even the carbon footprint, this is something that was cooked up by a PR firm working for British Petroleum. Take shorter showers? I mean.
I needed a shower after hearing that. Electrification gives us a way out of this debate, right? Like if we're going to argue with each other and sort of, you know, like, oh, you're taking 6 minute showers, you don't care about the climate. Like in a world when oil and gas companies are trying to drill in the Arctic, in a world where billionaires have used the pandemic to enrich themselves and fly around the world and have carbon footprints thousands of times that of an average person, we're going with take shorter showers as a message. That would piss me off too, if I didn't know anything about climate change. Maybe I'd become an opponent of it. Maybe that's the point. electrification gives us a way out of this. Go and have your shower. You've got a heat pump water heater. Now there's not really much of an impact at all of doing that. If you have a solar panel in your house, maybe you're making your own power too, right? Like there's ways to do this that are very, very sustainable, that don't require intrusion on people's lives in that way, that could very easily flip them over to being on the pro-climate side.
So that brings us to another thing that people are often told that they shouldn't do if they are pro-climate, that I can also imagine would tip them to the other side of the climate action debate. You've recently had your second child, and congratulations again for that. And I know you are very outspoken about this messaging that pops up every now and then about how having children is bad for the climate. Sticking with the earlier thread of hope that you keep injecting into this conversation, and thank you for that, what advice do you have? What do you say for other parents, to other parents or prospective parents, about what kind of future is possible for their children?
Well, first of all, it's not an empty hope, okay? It's an acknowledgement that there are different outcomes, and some of them are not awful, right? Some of them are awful. Some of them are truly apocalyptic, and that is still on the table. And we can't lose sight of that, because all it'll take is one lawless United States president to go through and use their power to undermine climate action. We're right on the razor's edge. As far as this having kids thing, like, I don't know how technical we need to get with this answer, but it's very important that people understand that every couple months, someone writes an article that says having a kid is the worst thing you can do for climate. You need to understand that is junk science. That, and I don't say that lightly. I don't usually trash other scientists' papers, but the reason why I'm so passionate about this one is the harm that this paper has caused, because it has turned into this meme that comes up over and over again, and it's just wrong. First of all, the authors of the piece that went viral, they didn't actually calculate that. Okay, that figure about how much additional carbon footprint you get per child that you have, they just took that from some other paper. And if you go and read that other paper, the way it was calculated, they said, okay, if you have a baby, I'm going to take that baby and attribute to them an additional per capita footprint that is the average footprint of Russia, Japan, and the United States. Okay, so they took three sort of random high emitting countries, mashed them together and said, well, that is an incremental addition of that much from the moment that child is born. And then we're going to assume that that baby has a baby and then that baby has a baby as well. And we're going to take all those footprints and assign them to your baby. So that's how they come up with this figure that if you have a child, it increases carbon footprint by three times that of an average human in North America. It's a bonkers number that makes absolutely no sense. If we are still consuming like that three generations from now, we will be in an apocalypse. Like I don't even know if it's physically possible to be doing that. I don't blame the authors necessarily in writing that paper originally, but the problem that I have with it is that it really should have been retracted at this point, or more effort should have been put into clarifying. Instead, quite the opposite. It's been promoted. Their university went to great lengths to promote that article, and it's caused a ton of damage. And people need to understand it's just not valid. It's just not a valid point.
So, Brett, we have come to the last question I ask in the show, and I ask the same question of everybody in the show. And that is, what radical change would you like to see play out in your lifetime? And how close are we?
A proliferation of the understanding of climate justice. So it's a bit abstract, but sort of understand, like, everyone on the street understanding that if you make a choice to build new fossil fuel infrastructure today, if you make a choice to do something that locks in an energy system that absolutely has to be wound down, that what you are doing is you are taking years away from future generations and giving them to yourself. I think if people understood that at a fundamental level, you know, the same as like if you're helping someone across the street, you can see the good deed, right? Climate change is more abstract than that. But they need to understand that it's literal robbery of future generations. It's constraining of their options. It's constraining of the places they can live. It's probably going to make them live shorter and sicker lives and more impoverished lives, right? Understanding that, and then think about, you know, the impact on seven or eight generations down the line. Like we arguably live in one of the most consequential times in human history, because the things that happen over the next decade are going to affect literal thousands of years of the Earth's geology, right? So if people understood that, the awesome weight that puts on us today, I think it would compel people with moral fiber to act, particularly those. And when I say this, you know, I'm referring to the people with means, right? Like there's people here that are not responsible for this, that don't have the means to do anything about it. Your job is just to get through life, right? Like there's different, if you have more power, if you have more money, you are more responsible for using those privileges, those resources to pull this problem in one direction or the other. So I think that's what I would hope, is that if we can proliferate this idea of justice, it's going to cause things like electrification to get done in a way that they wouldn't be if people don't feel responsible.
Thanks for joining us. My guest today was Brett Favaro, Dean of the Faculty of Science and Horticulture at Kwantlen Polytechnic University, and also author of The Carbon Code, How You Too Can Be a Climate Change Hero. The Second Transition podcast is produced on the traditional lands and treaty territories of the Mississauga of the Credit, also known as Dish with One Spoon Territory. Support for the Second Transition podcast comes in part from the Errol Food Institute and in part by Voice Ed Canada. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.